Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, May 4th, 2015. In Washington, they're talking about making some changes to the Patriot Act. But in fact, some of the proposed changes make it worse. And the net result is massive surveillance of innocent Americans will continue on a daily basis. Turn and face the strange changes. That's what we'll do today as we lead off our News and Comment podcast with an invitation for you to listen to our latest in-depth interview podcast at peterbcollins.com and all of our supporting outlets like Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, and you can always hear it at peterbcollins.com. We talk with J. Kirk Wiebe. He spent 32 years working for the National Security Agency, and he took retirement along with Bill Binney in late 2001 when they saw what was happening. How the agency that for years had defined its mission on spying outside of our borders was turning its powerful tools on innocent Americans. Kirk Wiebe is outspoken. We talk for over an hour about the way the government has been operating, and that the modest changes being proposed for the Patriot Act don't touch programs like PRISM that intercepts everything we do on the internet, including Skype and voice calls that are passed through the internet circuits. And yet our elected leaders are going through the motions, talking about that balance between security and privacy, and shredding our privacy as they do so. You want some mainstream references? Well, Sunday's New York Times has a front-page analysis piece called Giving In a Little on Data. And this is ludicrous because they talk about often in the Times how they only use anonymous sources when they absolutely have to. But in this article, they quote one recently departed senior intelligence official, "This is hardly major change." And when you map it out, in fact, nothing is really changing. They're going to continue to collect our phone records. They're just keeping them in a different place. And they claim that they'll require a court order to look at those records being held in a different place by the phone companies. But there is no real operational difference, and Kirk Wiebe lays it out for us. The proposal puts together a panel of outside advocates to provide guidance on civil liberties before the super-secret FISA court. Well, for years now, I've been saying that the FISA court should be abolished. It has no place in our system of government. The bill would require that all significant interpretations of surveillance law by the FISA court be made public. That's not a bad idea, but telling us that the court has approved more spying on us doesn't change the fact that we're all under surveillance on a regular basis, maybe even a continual basis. The bill requires the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence make public detailed information about how they use their national security authorities. Well, this is bullshit. At the end of every year, they'll just give you a table of numbers. 27,000 people had their cell phone calls intercepted. But, you know, it won't give us any real sense of what they're doing and how. And all the other types of surveillance remain in place. They're copying the name and addresses on every piece of mail that is delivered to you. Gosh, I hope they skip the junk mail. But it's really a farce. And if you listen to this powerful excerpt from my conversation with Kirk Wiebe, he opens by talking about why he supports H.R. House Resolution 1466. It's called the Surveillance State Repeal Act, and it's the only bill that will completely eliminate the Patriot Act, roll back the changes to the FISA law that Obama said he opposed and then voted for in 2008, and restrain the authority under the Presidential Directive 12333. Here's Kirk Wiebe.
We basically would turn the clock back to the day before 9/11 And let me tell you why that's a good thing. If you ask Thomas Drake directly, did the NSA have the information already before any of this Patriot Act and all the subsequent legislation happened? Could they, did they have it? He will tell you they not only had it, but they found even more in their databases.
And Kirk, I have asked Tom Drake that. He did answer just as you have suggested. And not only that, he became extremely emotional and told me how he wakes up at night thinking about this. And so it was very compelling to hear Drake describe that. And that is a notion that is completely lost in the avalanche of bullshit that surrounds our domestic spying programs.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And now people must say, so why did they push it? Why are they so protective of this entire invasion of our privacy? I will state it again. It is for their own purposes. It isn't for the security of the nation. It's for monetary. It's for agendas. It's for politics. And let me tell you, if you don't think people in government are corrupt and willing to use this power, you better wake up. We have corruption throughout the society. It's in business. It's in government. It's everywhere. It's all about the me factor. I'm going to get mine while I can, and that's the way I measure my own self-esteem and success in life. It isn't about us, the nation, the country, the Constitution that keeps us free and healthy. Politically, it's about getting mine. We are now facing the most dangerous time in the history of the country. I don't know that we can hold it together. I am a little optimistic that the younger group coming along, the younger generations who have grown up with electronic devices, feel angry about the fact that they cannot do so privately. And I'm hoping this anger turns into action.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with J. Kirk Wiebe, and it completes my interviews with the first wave of NSA whistleblowers, Tom Drake, Bill Binney, Russell Tice, Kirk Wiebe. And to a person, they all appreciate what Ed Snowden did, putting himself on the line to provide the documents that confirm what these early whistleblowers have told us. And I give the New York Times some credit in their lead editorial on Sunday. They deplore the minor modifications being made to the Patriot Act. And I failed to mention a moment ago that this new law, in order to bring along some knuckle-dragging, tough-on-crime Republicans, actually increases the sentence from 15 to 20 years for the murkiest of the terrorism crimes that the FBI has been using to set up, frame, and convict people. And that is the language of material support. But the New York Times, in its editorial, says the new bill, the USA Freedom Act, was passed by the House Judiciary Committee Thursday, 25-2 vote, sent to the floor for what seems like near-certain approval. And it notes that the bill does not end the bulk collection of surveillance data under Section 215. It limits those operations, which, in addition to eroding the Bill of Rights, have been shown to be worthless in protecting America. Well, they're right about that. But the charade will continue, the political theater of the surveillance state. And as Kirk Wiebe points out, this is all being done to feed other agendas, not our security. It's the profiteering by the contractors and their cronies who go through the revolving door of government jobs. It's the deep state who wants to keep us in fear and in perpetual war for motives that are not usually very clear to you and me. And it will continue. There's simply no doubt about it. And it is a huge disgrace to us. Also in Sunday's Times, I credit the public editor, Margaret Sullivan. She offers some good criticism of her own newspaper. That's her job. And in Sunday's column, she talked about the reporting a week ago that we had commented on, where the Times named three top CIA officials against the pleading of the CIA. They want their identities kept secret. And it's one of the rare opportunities I have to offer some praise for Dean Baquet, who is the executive editor of the New York Times. And I've been sharply critical of Baquet because as he traversed from the Los Angeles Times to the Washington Post to the New York Times, he's left a trail. And that trail includes at the LA Times, he saw the early information that was delivered by Mark Klein, the courageous former AT&T technician here in San Francisco who exposed the room on Folsom Street where they were diverting all of the traffic coming through a major switching center into a secret room that fed it to an undisclosed NSA location. Dean Baquet not only instructed his reporters not to publish what Mark Klein told them, he turned it over to the government. Then he was promoted to the Post, then to the Times, then they made him the top editor. So with that as background, and this discussion of the decision he made to publish the names of these three top CIA officers, he told Margaret Sullivan, "We've learned about the perils of not monitoring and policing warfare as rigorously as possible, and of too readily agreeing to government requests to withhold information. We were too soft years ago. At least, I'll say that I was." Well, next, if you really mean it, Dean Baquet, spelled B-A-Q-U-E-T, send a letter of apology to Mark Klein. That would be a start. Now, here is a murky announcement from the Justice Department, which is just 1 week into its new leadership under Attorney General Loretta Lynch. And according to Sunday's Wall Street Journal, the Justice Department will start revealing more about the government's use of secret cell phone tracking devices. We've talked about these at length. We've helped expose the Stingray program through the work of the great investigative reporter Bo Hodai. And the journal itself has helped expose the program called Dirt Boxes. And these are essentially these Stingray systems that are placed in airplanes, and they fly over an airport, and they capture all of the cell phone signals of everybody who's at that airport. So this really fits the description of the term dragnet. And you can imagine at any given airport, you're looking for one or more suspects, but there are thousands of innocent people who you are monitoring, tracking, using these devices. They are clear violations of the Fourth Amendment. The programs are called Stingray, Hailstorm, Dirtbox. They have a few other names. Mostly they're made by the Harris Corporation, and they were developed for the federal government, but they have been farmed out to local law enforcement. And for example, in Baltimore, which is the center of honest law enforcement, right? Between 2007 and 2014, the Stingray was used 4,300 times. Now, I don't know how many terrorist plots they've been busting up in Baltimore. But you know from that frequency, 4,300, that they're not using these devices simply to track terrorists. And so, with the exposure of the dirt box, one unnamed law enforcement official told the Journal, at some point, it becomes more harmful to try to keep it secret than to acknowledge it. And there are no protocols about the different federal departments who use the device, much less the local agencies who use it. The FBI doesn't require or provide legal standards to police on how to use these devices. They just give them to them. And Verizon Wireless noted an 8% increase in emergency requests by law enforcement for people's cell phone numbers in the second half of 2014, some of which can be linked to the use of Stingray and related surveillance devices. Well, When I first heard this news about the shooting in Texas, it's just a trifecta of perversion. So here you have Pam Geller, who is a self-appointed agent provocateur, and she may be more than self-appointed. Who knows who funds Pamela Geller? But she's made her focus in life to attack Muslims ever since 9/11. She is shrill. She is provocative. And she is insightful. And the spelling of that is important. I-N-C-I-T-E. Insightful. I'm not even sure it's a word. But I'm making a play on the other spelling of insightful based on insight. No, Pam Geller prefers to incite people. And so she created the context where some gunmen claiming fealty to Islam showed up and tried to shoot it up. The event was a competition to draw renderings of the Prophet Muhammad, deeply offensive to virtually all Islams. They dangled a $10,000 prize. They rented a hotel room in Texas for the sole reason that it had previously been used by Muslims to respond to the attack on the Charlie Hebdo office in Paris this past January. And so we've got sick, twisted fucks like Pamela Geller who lay out bait in a state like Texas where guns are prevalent. Now, these guys rolled over the border from Arizona. One of them is named Elton Simpson, no relation to Bart. He's from Phoenix, and his alleged former roommate, Nadir Sufi. They reportedly arrived at this hotel outside Dallas in the city of Garland. They started firing almost immediately. They dinged a security guard. And then the account is a little bit fuzzy about exactly who shot and killed these two gunmen who were invading the anti-Muslim concocted event. Now, here is the third layer of the trifecta. We've got provocation, we've got easy access to guns, and we've got FBI surveillance. Because this suspect, Simpson, he's now dead. He was charged in 2010 with plotting to travel to Somalia for the purpose of engaging in violent jihad. So the FBI once again knew about this guy. And, you know, they work so hard to bust up these terrorist plots, prevent people from joining the Islamic State. And when you look closely at most of those cases, they are pure fabrication. And here's a guy, let's say like a Tsarnaev brother. They know about him. He's in their records. He should be a subject of all that surveillance activity that I complain about. And yet, he was able to travel from Phoenix to Dallas, heavily armed, and show up and start shooting. It's a crazy world that we live in. And it is further crazed by what Kirk Wiebe referred to as the incredible corruption. Not only in government and politics, but notably there. Also, in just about every corner of American life, including corporate life. Every day I like to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Terry Paris, Cheryl Fleming, the incredible Faith Peoples, and all the way from New Zealand, Justin Keene has renewed his annual subscription. He moved there earlier this year from Singapore. And I appreciate each and every one of you. I'd like to see the ranks expand. I need more people to support my work because revenues have been declining a little bit here from subscriptions. And if you can help, I want to clearly say I do appreciate people who take out multiple subscriptions. And anyone is free to do that. I will never stop you. But my pitch, my plea is really to people who listen every day, who can afford to support it and haven't so far. So if that description fits you, come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click the sign-up link under my picture. Take a choice of $5, $10, $20 a month, or a best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers anywhere in the world get a copy of Pepe Escobar's ebook called Empire of Chaos. And Mr. Escobar gave us a great interview last week, and if you haven't heard it yet, it's available at peterbcollins.com. Now, I have never in my life said anything good about Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama. I have never found an opportunity to say, wow, Jeff Sessions is on the right side of an issue. After all, because of my deep coverage of the Siegelman case, I don't have a very favorable impression of the political and judicial cesspool in the great state of Alabama. But to my surprise, Jeff Sessions' staff emailed me over the weekend with a message that Jeff Sessions is completely against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He's also against fast-tracked authorization for it. And I said, really? Jeff Sessions? Now, Jeff put out a press release with five reasons why he's against it. And because he's such a dweeb, I'm not going to read them all to you. I can just say that they are actually reasonable. Jeff Sessions has lapsed into a kind of momentary reasonableness, coherence, and lucidity. And he opposes it for many of the same reasons that I do. But consider that the Trans-Pacific Partnership predates the Obama administration. Like healthcare reform, this is a package that came from the Republicans. And Jeff Sessions, to my knowledge, has been in favor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership up until this weekend when he sent out the grandstanding press release. He failed to list the sixth reason why he is unalterably opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The sixth reason is Obama is for it. A couple of quick updates for you. On the Mediterranean, 3,700 refugees were salvaged from smugglers' boats that were foundering on the open waters. There were a lot of launchings from Libya's coast because the seas were relatively calm over this past weekend. 16 boatloads were saved off Libya. And this does respond in some ways to one of the criticisms I offered. It appeared the Italians were just patrolling their own coastline. But this indicates that they are also patrolling along the coast of Libya and trying to rescue people before serious problems occur. 10 people were picked up who were already dead in the events of Sunday. And we have a statistic here that 170,000 were rescued at sea in 2014 just by the Italians. So that is a major wave of refugees that is continuing to flow northward. Oops, we did it again. And the results are really tragic. In an airstrike led by the American-led coalition, and I have to use that language because the U.S. has not copped to responsibility yet for this, but it's most likely it was an American fighter jet that hit targets inside Syria and killed 52 civilians, probably more. At least 9 of those were children, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is a slightly less than completely credible outlet. And the U.S. says we have no information to corroborate allegations that coalition airstrikes resulted in civilian casualties. But we take all allegations seriously, and we'll look into them further. Yeah. Now we learn that Saudi Arabia is using cluster bombs in Yemen. The evidence is on the ground, the little bomblets that fall from the mother bomb, and many of them don't explode, leaving live munitions around for innocent people to step on or to trigger. Human Rights Watch has made the report with some video evidence in support of it. And it's interesting to note this article from the New York Times reporting on it. Quote, cluster munitions, which are banned by much of the world, but not by the United States, Saudi Arabia, or Yemen, are considered imprecise weapons that spread ordnance over a wide area and pose long-term danger to civilians. What did they leave out there? They left out Israel. Israel uses cluster weapons. And, like the Saudis, they're one of the few products still made in America. Isn't that delightful to think that Americans crafted these bombs, these cluster bombs, and they're being bought at a rapid pace by our allies and dumped on these impoverished nations? There's more grisly detail coming out from last summer's war on Gaza by the State of Israel. More than 60 Israeli soldiers gave accounts to a human rights group called Breaking the Silence. And what the soldiers describe are lax rules of engagement, or non-existent rules of engagement, that allowed them, for example, to shoot and kill someone who was looking at them out a window because they could have been a scout. And that virtually any male could be shot and killed suspected of being a so-called militant. 2,200 Palestinians were killed, some 900 of them under the age of 18. And when you hear what the soldiers say, it contradicts what we're told about the great caution and care taken by the Israelis to avoid killing innocent people. But they knew going into war in a hot war in an urban area, one of the most densely populated areas on the planet, that there are lots of innocent people present. Here's a quote from one soldier. The area has to be sterilized, empty of people. And if we don't see someone waving a white flag screaming, "I give up," then he's a threat, and there's authorization to open fire. The saying was, there's no such thing there as a person who is uninvolved. In that situation, anyone there is involved. Well, this violates many treaties and the standards of warfare in the Geneva Conventions and elsewhere that say that you can't, you know, target or negligently kill innocent bystanders. So the rules of engagement, again quoting a soldier, for advancing on the ground were open fire everywhere, first thing when you go in. One company commander was quoted as saying that after a soldier, an Israeli soldier, was killed, "Guys, get ready, get in your tanks. We'll fire a barrage in memory of our comrade. My tank went up to the post, a place where I can see targets, can see buildings, and fired at them." And the platoon commander says, "Okay, guys, we'll now fire in memory of our comrade." Well, that, too, is a kind of biblical retribution that is clearly illegal. But when Israel does it, they claim it's self-defense. And this report summarizes that there were 34,000 shells that Israel fired into Gaza. 34,000. And they claim this was in self-defense because of these rockets that are fired by Hamas and others from Gaza, and that killed, I think, 4 or 5 Israelis. Now, I looked it up on the internets. There were 3,000 approximately rockets fired from Gaza into Israel in the month of July. And during that same month, Israel pounded Gaza with 34,000 shells. That's a 10-to-1 ratio. And that clearly is disproportionate and clearly immoral in my view. Our friend and colleague Gareth Porter has written another great analysis about the continuing talks with Iran. They are scheduled to resume this week. And regrettably, he makes a very clear point that essentially spells out that these talks are doomed, primarily because of domestic political considerations. He writes, "The Obama administration is no more likely to lurch into a new relationship with Iran than were previous U.S. administrations, and the reason is very simple. The U.S. national security state, which has the power to block any such initiative, has fundamental long-term interest in the continuation of the policy of treating Iran as an enemy. And Porter does a great job of explaining who the different pressure groups are, including Israel, the Saudis, and others. And he writes, at a deeper level, the most important factor in determining the policy of the U.S. toward Iran is domestic electoral and bureaucratic politics, not Obama's personal geopolitical vision of the Middle East. The power of the Israeli lobby obviously will severely limit policy flexibility toward Iran for many years, and the interests of the most powerful institutions in the U.S. security state remain tied to a continuation of the policy of treating Iran as the premier enemy of the U.S. And he concludes, but an even bigger bonanza for the U.S. arms industry is at stake. Saudi Arabia, other Gulf regimes, and the anti-Iran alliance have been pouring big money into Pentagon arms contractor coffers for years. A deal with Saudi Arabia for fighter planes and missile defense technology, first announced in 2010, was expected to yield up to $150 billion in procurement and service over two decades. Yep, follow the money. Follow the war profiteers. And finally today, a touching account from a photojournalist who works for Vice News named Sean Carey. Sean, a week ago today, was covering first the funeral of Freddie Gray and then what turned into riots on the streets of Baltimore. And let me read you some quotes lifted from his account that's at The Guardian today. I don't know why Vice didn't run it, but that's not my problem. He says, a line of riot police then charged into a throng of rioters. I followed them, camera in hand, trying to capture the tumultuous scene. I was hit directly in the forehead with a plastic, less lethal projectile that explodes with an irritant powder on impact. I stumbled over to the sidewalk. Everything went black for a moment. Next thing I saw were faces staring down at me as I lay on the grass. Stunned, I got up, tried to continue reporting. Within a few minutes, the intersection cleared and the riot squad stood at bay. A few television cameras remained and I joined them to try to snap some photos of the police line. An officer from behind the line came up to me and told me I needed to move. I reached into my jacket to show my press pass, asked the armor-clad giant which way I should go. He started to say, I don't know, but you can't stay here, and was interrupted by a captain barking, him! He goes! Before I could say another word, I was thrown to the ground and put in handcuffs. I was brought over behind the police lines to sit behind an armored vehicle where I would remain with my arresting officer for 2 hours. I heard him say to another cop, I don't even know why they told me to lock this guy up. He's a reporter. But reporter or not, I was now under arrest and on my way to central booking. The jail was crammed, cells marked single had as many as 5 people, those marked group had up to 9 prisoners crammed inside. He says, in jail, the correction officers are God and master, savior and executioner. All requests for basic necessities like water, toilet paper, food, or medical attention were brusquely denied. Every 8 hours when food arrived, it was a uniform regimen of 1 elementary school milk carton and 4 slices of laundered bread matter, with 1 slice of either a yellowish cheese substance or processed bologna. It was utterly inedible. So, he was there for a total of 49 hours. He writes, in jail, your constitutional rights are worth about as much as the food they feed you. Asking to see a lawyer when it took 4 hours to get water was like asking for caviar. When I cited the Fourth and Sixth Amendment protecting due process and Maryland state law banning detainment beyond 24 hours without a charge and statement of probable cause, the COs told us that the state of emergency meant that 24 hours is out the window. We pleaded to talk to someone, anyone. When I asked one of the higher-ups, the lieutenant, what he was doing to ensure that the law was being followed, he told me bluntly, they are violating your rights, and everyone here knows it. Sometime on Wednesday, lawyers arrived. One of them looked at me, saw the bruise on my forehead, and said, oh, are you the reporter? She was from the Maryland Office of the Public Defender, and they filled out a habeas corpus petition, and about 4 hours later, He said, I was given a bag with my name on it containing my jacket, my wallet, and camera equipment. There were police. There were riot police with shields lining the hallway as they led a single file down a long hallway. At the end of the corridor, a sergeant pressed a button and a bright door opened. She said, get out. Well, that's a real-life experience in Baltimore, Maryland. And this is a white guy with a press pass. You can fill in the rest. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you're authorized to share with absolutely anyone. So please get started. Pass it around. Spread the word. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.